The housing crisis might not immediately seem like the most scintillating backdrop for a novel. The writer Paul Auster wanted to write about problems facing young people today and to explore the idea of losing a home. The result is his latest novel, Sunset Park. NPR's Lynn Neary met with Auster in his own home, not far from the neighborhood where his story is set.
Paul Auster lives in a prosperous neighborhood just a few blocks from Brooklyn's Prospect Park. His shaded street is lined with elegant brownstones, much like his own. Inside, the house is a sophisticated combination of old and new. Auster leads me upstairs to the family room, where the walls are lined floor to ceiling with books.
Great place.
Yeah, it's a wonderful house.
You have so many books in here. It's beautiful.
We have books all over the house. We're just bursting.
The meaning of home and homelessness is at the core of Auster's latest novel, Sunset Park. Home, Auster says, is a place where you should feel absolutely safe.
It's the place where you don't really have to explain yourself or defend yourself. I think that's the ideal that everyone holds in his head, is that this is the place where you're welcome, no matter what you've done, no matter how rocky things have become for you. And unfortunately, not everyone has this refuge.
Auster wanted to explore what happens when the sense of security that comes with home is taken away. The main character in the book, Miles Heller, lives in self-imposed exile from his home and family in New York. As the book opens, Miles is working in Florida, clearing out the possessions of families who have been evicted. Circumstances force Miles to return to New York, where he takes up an old friend's offer to live in a run-down house where he and some friends are squatting, rent-free. In this passage, read by Auster, Miles sees the house for the first time.
This house in Sunset Park is neither suburban nor historic. It is merely a shack, a forlorn piece of architectural stupidity that would not fit in anywhere, neither in New York nor out of it. Bing didn't send any photographs with his letter, didn't describe what it looked like in any detail, and therefore he had no idea what to expect. But if he did expect anything, it certainly wasn't this.
Auster based this imaginary house on a real one he saw one day in Sunset Park, a neighborhood not far from his home. A short drive brings us there. It's an urban mix of small businesses, warehouses, and residential buildings with none of the charm of Auster's own neighborhood. It is not, as Auster says, a desperate place. Instead, he describes it as mournful. We pull up to the lot where the house once stood. It's been demolished, but Auster remembers what the house looked like the day he found it.
It looked like a farmhouse from the Midwest, built about 120 years ago. And I thought, well, this abandoned house would be the perfect place for young people to break into and want to live there. So I used that as the model in my head as I was writing the book.
The young people who lived in Auster's imaginary house decided to become squatters for different reasons. The instigator, Bing, saw it as a political act.
Bing is a contrarian. He's against everything that's happening. So he wants to strike a blow for some future world in which there's more justice and kindness. And this, in his misconstrued way, he conceives of as the best way to do it.
Auster's book is set not only in a real neighborhood, but also squarely in the middle of real events. At this moment in history, Auster says, the sense of displacement that comes with economic uncertainty is a situation that all too many people are experiencing.
The germ of this book came with the idea of someone being expelled, thrown out of the place where he lived. But the more I thought about it, the more I meditated, the more I saw that actually this problem was growing into an enormous social problem in the United States simultaneously. And so I suppose this inner condition of being dispossessed and also the outer condition of so many people living in this terrible flux of broken mortgages, default, and expulsion also all coalesced into what the book became.
Auster's not known for writing novels that deal with the social conditions of the day. Even so, he doesn't see Sunset Park as a departure from his other work.
I mean, history is present in all of my novels. And whether I'm directly talking about the sociological moment or just immersing my characters in that environment, I'm very aware of it.
No one, says Auster, gets through life without facing some adversity. Ultimately, that's what intrigues him as a novelist, the exploration of how people deal with the very real problems that inevitably come their way. Lynn Neary, NPR News.
And at our website, you can listen to Paul Auster read a chapter from his novel Sunset Park. That's at npr.org. Our program is directed by Brendan Banizak, edited by Allison McAdam, and produced by Neil Carruth. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson. Audio engineers include Neil Rausch, Manya Zuba, and Manoli Wetherill at NPR New York, Carlos Asensio, Marcia Caldwell, Leo Delagila, Theo Mondel, Patrick Murray, and Luke Hapaya at NPR West, at News Operations, Charlie Mayer, Bob Duncan, Bill Craven, and Rolando Arrieta. The executive producer of All Things Considered is Christopher Turpin. I'm Melissa Block. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is a voice we used to hear all the time, a voice that's gone silent in the past 2 years.
I hope I'm judged a success. I'm going to be dead, Matt, when they finally figure it out. And I'm comfortable knowing that I gave it my all, that I love America, and that and I know it's an honor to serve.
Former President George W. Bush is back in the spotlight with his new memoir titled Decision Points. That was Mr. Bush on NBC. We have a review of Decision Points now from the presidential historian H.W. Brands.
The memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant are generally considered the finest by any former president. There are two secrets to Grant's enduring success. First, the book deals almost exclusively with the period prior to Grant's presidency, thus providing insight into the man who became president rather than the president himself. Second, Grant in the memoir displays a capacity for sobering reflection, admitting where his mistakes during the Civil War sent thousands of soldiers needlessly to their deaths. Former President George W. Bush cites Grant's memoir as inspiration for his own, but it differs in both crucial regards. Bush devotes one chapter and parts of a few others to his pre-presidential career, but the great majority of the book concerns his 8 years in the White House. This serves his literary and political purpose, which is to make the case for his policies as president. But it does little to reveal the inner man, and the absence of broad reflection leaves some large historical questions unanswered. As a justification for his actions, Bush's memoir succeeds admirably. The former president revisits nearly all the controversial decisions of his tenure and defends them with vigor. The war in Afghanistan was necessary to root out al-Qaeda and the Taliban and create a free society in Central Asia, he says. The war in Iraq turned out to be based on faulty intelligence, but the consequence of the American occupation was a chance for democracy to take root in the Persian Gulf. When CIA Chief George Tenet asked Bush if he approved waterboarding against terrorist suspects, the president said, "Damn right," and he still thinks he was right. Bush's tax cuts were required to counteract the recessionary effects of 9/11, he says. The rescue of Wall Street in 2008 was distasteful but necessary. As Bush told an advisor at the time, "If we're really looking at another Great Depression, you can be damn sure I'm going to be Roosevelt, not Hoover." Bush acknowledges some tactical errors. He should have moved faster to deploy federal troops to the Gulf Coast after Hurricane Katrina. He should have pushed for immigration reform before Social Security reform, following his 2004 re-election. He still gets a, quote, sickening feeling when he thinks of the missing weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But he admits to no major blunders, and he avoids the larger issues his time in office raises. Chronologically, Bush's was the first president of the 21st century, but historians may well view it as the last presidency of the 20th century, of the era when America's economic power invited, almost compelled, an ambitious foreign policy. That era has ended, not least because of what happened during George W. Bush's presidency. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan strained the federal budget. The Bush tax cuts, the financial crisis, and the ensuing recession have nearly broken it. There will be no more elective wars like Iraq, not for a long time. Before Bush, Americans could have guns and butter both. After Bush, we'll be lucky simply to have butter. Bush closes by saying he's comfortable with the fact that history's verdict on his presidency won't come until after he's gone. That's just as well, since history isn't likely to be as easy on him as he is on himself.
Historian H.W. Brands is the author of Traitor to His Class, about President Franklin Roosevelt. You're listening to All Things Considered. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. Today, the president's bipartisan deficit commission released a draft of its recommendations. The commission's task is to find ways to help the U.S. dig itself out of a huge financial hole. Its preliminary report calls for cuts in domestic and military spending, reductions in benefits for some future Social Security recipients, and an overhaul of the tax code. For more details, we are joined by NPR's Mara Liasson. And Mara, tell us more about what they're recommending here.
Well, the two chairmen of the commission, Republican Alan Simpson and Democrat Erskine Bowles, have come up with a blueprint for how, starting in about 2 years when they assume that the economy will have recovered a bit, to reduce the deficit and ensure Social Security solvency for 75 years. And it lays out a menu of options to get government spending in line with revenue, cuts in domestic and military spending, raising the retirement age, reducing Social Security benefits, subjecting more income to Social Security taxes, simplifying the tax code, reducing tax rates, but also getting rid of a lot of tax breaks. And what this document really does is challenge Republicans, who've been saying this all can be done with spending cuts, so far unspecified spending cuts, and the left that's been saying it can all be done with tax hikes on the rich. So if they don't like what's in here, it challenges them to come up with their own alternatives.
And how do these commission chairmen propose to get where they're headed?
Well, they give 50 examples of how to get $200 billion of spending out of the budget by 2015 in domestic and military cuts, including one of the very smallest options they offer, which is cutting the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is $500 million. Mm-hmm. But it lays out how you could get income tax rates lowered under different scenarios, depending how many tax breaks you're willing to modify or cancel, including the mortgage interest deduction, the exclusion for employer-provided health benefits, charitable deductions. Now, all of those are considered political kryptonite, and there's a big question whether Republicans will consider getting rid of these tax breaks, the same thing as a tax hike. It also makes suggestions on how to control long-term health care costs. You could say that they are proposing to man up the new health care law in this regard.
A final report, Mara, will be out about 3 weeks from now. And after that, for any of this to become reality, Congress has to take it up. That is politically challenging, to say the least.
Well, the first political challenge is, will the commission actually recommend anything officially? It takes 14 of the 18 commissioners to do that. Unless they do that, Congress is not required to vote on any of this. But even if they don't get the 14 votes, this could be a blueprint for others to work with. Now, President Obama issued a statement saying he's going to wait to see what they do on December 1st. But so far, it's getting a lot of praise from deficit hawks, a lot of boos from the left saying Social Security shouldn't be touched. Instead, we should raise taxes on the rich. But I think the reaction is what you'd expect, and remarkably open on a lot of fronts.
You know, when I talked to the commission chairman earlier this year, when they were heading out, Alan Simpson joked that they were jumping off the cliff here. They called it a suicide mission. Do you think this plays well politically, Mara?
Well, I think it is provocative. I think that's what they meant it to be. This is an issue whose time may have come again. And the message of the election was supposedly about the deficit and debt and spending. Certainly, it was the rallying cry of the Tea Party. And although the deficit was pretty low on the list of priorities in the exit polls, the economy and jobs were much higher. And when voters are asked about specifics like raising the retirement age, they tend to reject them. Mm-hmm. But there is a sense that voters are ready to consider the trade-offs and make the sacrifices because they understand that without doing anything about our fiscal situation, America will really cease to be globally competitive.
Okay, we'll see what comes out of the commission later. NPR's Mara Liasson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Islamic scholar Reza Aslan wants to bring Westerners a clearer view of the part of the world where he was born, so he's turned to literature. His new anthology is called Tablet and Pen, Literary Landscapes of the Modern Middle East.
That landscape is broad. It stretches from the early 1900s when Kemal Ataturk founded a modern secular Turkey to the present-day theocracy of Iran. The poems and essays are linked by religion and the common experience of Western imperialism. One work is by the Pakistani poet Kishwar Nahid, who's also a political activist. Reza Aslan read an excerpt from one of her poems, a poem she calls To the Masters of Countries with a Cold Climate.
My country is torrid. Maybe that is why my feet burn. My country is torrid. Maybe that is why there are boils on my body. And she goes on at the end, she says, "Don't teach me to hate my torrid country. Let me dry my wet clothes in these courtyards. Let me plant gold in its fields. Let me quench my thirst at its rivers. Let me rest beneath the shade of its trees. Let me wear its dust and wrap its distances around me."
Kishwar Naheed is unknown to most Americans. That's not the case with Lebanese-born poet Khalil Gibran. A lot of students carry his work around in their back pockets, as I did as a teenager.
Khalil Gibran, of course, is one of the Arab world's most famous poets. Most Westerners know him for his collection, The Prophet, a book that, like you, Renee, I carried around when I was a kid. I decided, instead of focusing on his poetry, to start the entire collection with an essay he wrote about the revival of the Arabic language as a means of forming identity. He says here, "What is the best means to revive the Arabic language? The best and only means is to be found in the poet's heart, on his lips, and at his fingertips. The poet is the mediator between the power of invention and humanity. The poet is both the father and the mother of language. Language travels the same roads he travels and stops to rest where he stops to rest. And if the poet dies, language sits on his grave, crying over the loss, wailing until another poet passes by and extends his hands to it. And if the poet is both the father and the mother of language, the imitator is the weaver of its shroud and the digger of its grave." Gibran goes on to say that the only way to sort of push back against Western colonialism and to create a firm sense of Arabness is through the power of invention that comes from language. It is only the poets and the writers who can create the future of the Arab world.
Which also was strongly linked at this time early in the 20th century to independence itself.
What's really interesting about this collection is that the great poets and writers, whether we're talking about Turkish, Arabic, Urdu, or Persian, were the ones who really created the intellectual foundation for independence from colonialism. They are the ones who essentially gave birth to the modern states of the Middle East. But what's fascinating is that most of them lived to really regret that decision. In fact, many of these poets and writers whose words defined the modern Middle East were then quickly made to be the enemies of those states. Many of them were imprisoned by the very same governments that they helped put into power.
Right, which moves you, in terms of the way this literature is laid out, to the part of history that included a perception of what was lost.
You look at a poet like Nazım Hikmet, one of Turkey's greatest poets, whose words really gave shape to a Turkish identity and really pushed forward the notion of a Turkey free from the bonds of the Ottoman Empire. And then, of course, once Turkey became an independent state, suddenly Nazım Hikmet found himself to be an enemy of the state. One of his greatest poems that is in the collection is a poem called "Since I Was Thrown Inside." He was jailed for almost a decade by Ataturk's regime. And this poem goes like this. "Since I was thrown inside, the earth has orbited the sun 10 times. And just as passionately, I repeat what I wrote the year I was thrown inside. The people who are plentiful as ants on the ground, as fish in the sea, as birds in the sky, who are cowardly, courageous, ignorant, supreme, and childlike. It is they who crush and create. It is but their exploits sung in songs. And as for the rest, my 10-year incarceration, for instance, it's all meaningless words." And so these words that ultimately gave birth to the Turkish state end up creating a situation in which the poet himself becomes the enemy of that state.
Could you give us an example of a poem from somewhere in the region that speaks truth to power?
Going to Iran, now that we're in a situation in which the government that replaced the government of the Shah turned out to be just as bad, if not worse, than what we had before the revolution, the poets are once again training their pens, this time against the mullahs who run the state. And what you see now is a real sense of dispossession, a sense of loss amongst a lot of these poets who feel as though their voices are being stifled. This is a poem by a very young poet named Hamid Reza Rahimi. It's called A Quarter to Destruction. I live like a bird that does not know why it sings, like a tree that does not know why it grows, like a breeze that does not know why it blows, and like a fish that does not know why all the rivers of the world empty in the frying pans. In a sense, what we're seeing now from the poets is a real sense of melancholy, I would have to say. I think what you get when you read these works is that it breaks through all the stereotypes that we have of this region. You have this sense that the people of the Middle East are, in their poems, in their fiction and nonfiction, dealing with the same struggles of the human soul that we are all dealing with, that they are in conflict with their rulers. And sometimes that's an important thing to keep in mind, because we in the United States have a tendency to think that the people of the region and the leaders of the region are one and the same. But all you have to do is read these works to know that that is certainly not the case. They want to be what all peoples everywhere want to be, and that is people who are free to make up their own minds, to decide for themselves who will lead them and who will lead them where. And in a sense, that's the whole point of this book.
Reza Aslan, a pleasure to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Writer Reza Aslan has brought together a century's worth of poems and essays in his new anthology, Tablet and Pen: Literary Landscapes from the Modern Middle East.
Be careful what promises you make. You might hear that from a man named Jock Brandis. His life changed when he promised a group of African women he'd help them find a better way to shell their peanut crop. Well, that promise turned Brandis into a social entrepreneur focused on creating technology for poor farmers in the developing world. We've been profiling social entrepreneurs from time to time, and NPR's Larry Abramson brings us the story of Jock Brandis.
Some men's minds are drawn to puzzles. For Jock Brandis, here's the puzzle today: how to coax the oil from a bunch of peanuts using muscle power and some scraps of metal.
The oil wants to get out, but it has to now go upstream, right?
Right.
Why don't we think about doing something radical and drilling?
Brandis is brainstorming with Nathan Hansen, a local high school student who comes by Brandis's workshop after school to tinker. Last time Brandis was in Africa, he noticed that farmers there buy peanut oil from abroad, even though they have a surplus of homegrown nuts. So when he got back home, he and Nathan went hunting for cheap parts to make a peanut press.
Nathan and I enjoyed the wonders of the Great American Scrapyard, and we found this perfect piece of steel which fits this screw perfectly. So I think, as your mentor, I'm suggesting to you that you shut this down and we tear this apart.
At age 64, Jock Brandis is reveling in his second career. He shuffles about his workshop with the air of an artist whose creations are never quite finished. His machines look like whimsical children's sculptures made from found objects, oil drums and tires. They're scattered about the ramshackle workshop that's home to his nonprofit Full Belly Project in Wilmington, North Carolina. Brandis wasn't always a do-gooder. His first career was in the sometimes bloody world of B-movies. Jack Brandis did lighting for movies you might have seen in college and can now find listed under cult classics like the legendary Scanners, a thriller about a telekinetic psychopath. Brandis even had a bit part. But you have to look quickly. Brandis soon dies a violent film death. While not very highbrow, low-budget movies taught Jock Brandis a key skill: how to make something out of nothing.
You know, the director saying, all right, next Thursday we got to do a flying saucer flies into the Brooklyn Bridge, and we need to do three takes and blah, 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 and here's your budget. And we say, okay. And you just do it.
That's what he did for a living until he made that famous promise. We travel back in time to 2001. Brandis goes to West Africa on a lark to help a friend building a drinking water project. He notices African women shelling thousands of peanuts by hand. It was slow and painful.
And then I promised the local village women that I was going to send them back a peanut sheller. And when I came back to America to buy it, it didn't exist.
There were no small-scale peanut shellers, so Jack Brandis used his can-do chutzpah to cook up a gizmo that is powering a quiet agricultural revolution in 17 countries. Shelled peanuts rain down from Brandis's most famous creation, the Universal Nutsheller. Assistant Nathan Hansen provides the pedal power, and Jack Brandis pours in handfuls of peanuts.
And here they are, completely shelled and cleaned. And this machine can do a ton of peanuts a day quite easily.
Brandis says that villagers with their own sheller go from being subsistence farmers dependent on middlemen to independent business people. They can shell as much as they need for market and keep the rest fresh in their shells. Rick Brandenburg, who teaches at North Carolina State University, has seen incomes and quality of life in these villages improve dramatically.
The price can double if you can get them to the market at the right time. So it's just not a matter of time saving and allowing them to do other things with their family or other ways to produce income. It allows them to market their crop when the price is right.
Now, Brandis does not give his gadgets away. He sells the sheller design for about $28 a piece. That makes farmers invest in a mini factory. They get a set of instructions and some molds so they can build their own shellers. To make sure things work out, Brandis turns to local development people who know the region.
This is going to be going out with the Smith family, and the Smiths, they're going to go to Niger. They're going to be using this technology in Niger, and this is waiting for them to pack up.
And this is a pump?
This is two pumps. Or this is a factory for two pumps.
Brandis hopes these simple water pumps will be a worthy sequel to his famous nutsheller. They allow farmers to hand pump water over a couple of acres so they can plant a variety of crops all year long. Jack Brandis opens a big garage door. Behind his workshop lies the graveyard of great ideas, inventions that never made it.
And then there's peanut threshers, a bunch of bad ideas in peanut threshers, some turbine windmills around.
Among the projects he builds for others, Brandis has found something for himself.
I'm having way more fun than you could ever imagine. And the idea of stopping doing this seems completely unthinkable.
There are so many problems that can be tackled with an oil drum and a few spare parts. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And let's go next to Chicago, where parents are protesting over school libraries or the lack of them. Nearly a quarter of the city's elementary schools and several high schools do not have full library facilities. Parents say this is holding the kids back. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports on what they're doing about it.
A group of parents and activists are meeting at La Casita. The ramshackle field house on the grounds of Whittier Elementary School was their home for 43 days.
This is our library in the casita.
Evelyn Santos, a college student and one of the protest organizers, walks to the back room. It's full of books, some cataloged neatly on shelves, others in milk cartons, some still packed in boxes. On the wall, a child's drawing of two dogs with the message, "Welcome to the library," in Spanish.
I believe we have more than 4,000 books in here.
Santos says the group started collecting books at the beginning of their protest, with donations pouring in from all over the state. Librarians came by, too, donating their time to help put the books in order.
The students here need a library in order for them to get the proper skills to prosper in high school and in college.
The Fieldhouse Library is off limits to students now until parents and the school board resolve their battle over its use. Inside the school building, classrooms have book collections, but parent Michelle Palencia, who has a 6-year-old son at the school, says that's inadequate.
They don't have the accessibility that you need to get everything they need done, like reports and projects and just get basic information.
Carolina Gaete says without a library and trained librarians, the students at Whittier are at a disadvantage as they try to meet academic standards.
We are being evaluated with schools that have more resources, that have the tools necessary to excel. You want us to compete, you want us to beat in a race with one leg.
There are 600-plus public schools in the Chicago district, and about 160 don't have libraries. Julie Walker with the American Association of School Librarians says she understands parents' concerns.
We feel that students should be immersed in reading materials, you know, from the time they wake up in the morning until the time they go to bed at night.
Paul Witsit, who oversees the school's central library department, says he'd like to see all of the city's public schools with fully staffed libraries, but
nationwide there is a shortage of trained school librarians, especially in urban and rural areas. So sometimes that's the issue. Sometimes it's just a budgetary issue.
And like many school systems across the country, the Chicago public schools face a deep budget deficit. Principals and local school councils control most of the budget, and libraries often lose out in the competition for space as schools look to update resources. At Whittier, for example, there's a new computer lab, a new science lab, and an expanded lunchroom. The school district says it could convert a classroom into a library, but parents say some grades are already sharing classrooms, so the field house is a better option. Spokeswoman Monique Bond says the district has funds to put libraries in schools that need rebuilding.
But that is with a school that's overcrowded and desperately needs expansion.
And Whittier, says Bond, does not meet those criteria, so the negotiations continue. And while all involved say they now agree that a library is needed, the problem continues to be where. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.